Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't it fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind
playing
it, but lower it.
Are we going straight
now? No, we had a problem. We tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Nice! Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
I feel like Chris Brady's been holding out on me.
How's that?
You waltz into my house with an Aquarian super pad, and it's one of the best feeling practice pads I've ever played on. And Chris is not even selling me on it, man.
It's so weird because I have two of them. I have a 14 and a 10. What's up?
I just want a 14, man. That's all I want. And on top of that, you know, here I have been over the last 5 months publishing this Accountability Thursday thing.
Superpad's seen a lot of action on that.
It has seen a lot of action on it, but not on the original poster's video.
So weird.
It's so strange, man. Isn't that amazing? I mean, there's been some heretics practice pad been on this on this show, and then all of a sudden this guy waltzes into my house and brings this great practice pad in.
If only we knew somebody that could take care of that for you.
You know, I think what I might have a friend of a friend that can get in touch with somebody at Aquarian.
I'll see if I can put in a word.
Yeah,
put in a good word.
See if they know a way that I can get a hold of a 14-inch super pad.
That'd be cool.
That will be publicized on numerous videos seen by thousands of people every week.
Well, thousands might be a stretch.
Hey, now.
It'll be seen by tens of people every week.
Man, we're up to 18 regular listeners now. Did anybody with their years of ear training figure out that sitting across from me today, it's not John Chalden? It's one of our past guests and Drummer's Weekly Groovecast Advisory Board member. Welcome to the show, Dave Johnstone. Dave, it's glad to have you back, man.
Man, so good to be here. It's an honor.
Tell these folks why you are roaming around Atlanta right now.
Well, I came in a day early because I'm playing tomorrow night in Augusta with Aubrey Logan. We are doing a concert with the Augusta Symphony tomorrow night.
You have any weird feelings about following a conductor?
We'll see. I don't so far. You know, I'm going to count everything off and they can follow me. That's the vibe.
I was just going to say. It's all following the drummer these days, right? You're holding the cards.
Wasn't there that famous Elvin Jones quote? Something about like, the modern rhythm section has eliminated the need for a conductor. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah. It's funny, man. I was actually talking to somebody that was talking about Elvin in that sort of a quote yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. But also, before we start diving into the topic, I want to illustrate a point that was so well made by the person sitting across the table from me yesterday. Ryan Brown, I'm holding your feet to the fire. The next time I'm out in L.A., you're going to fly me into Burbank, because that's where Dave, he flew out of Burbank yesterday, and he said it was so delightful.
It's the only way to do it. I flew out of Burbank and then landed in the hellhole of the Atlanta airport.
Yeah, it kind of made up for it, didn't it, on the other end?
I had both extremes yesterday.
Very nice. We thought what we would do today is, since Dave is here in town with the fantastic singer and trombonist Aubrey Logan, that we would spend some time talking about working with vocalists, because it is it's a different animal than working purely with instrumentalists, or for that matter, really working even with anything else, like whether it be an orchestra or doing recording sessions or whatnot. Working live with vocalists is a very different thing. I mean, you had this great quote, man.
Yeah, this is a Neil Peart quote, actually. He says, "Drummers have the hardest job, but singers have the worst job."
That's pretty good.
So think about that for a second. That's definitely true.
there's something about having that drum set back there being our desk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can kind of sneak off back behind it,
mm-hmm.
regardless of it being the proverbial hot seat.
Well, another Neil quote, actually, he calls it the backline meridian, I think.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Like, yeah. you're kind of safe back there. You're protected.
Yeah.
You got up.
Now that you threw the backline thing out, I want to throw a personal challenge out to you. You're going to be doing the old spin the wheel of backline, mm-hmm. over the next couple of days.
Backline roulette.
Here's what I want you to do. Regardless of the quality of the backline, take a quick picture, post it on our website, and say, this is what I got.
All right.
Because could be something really good. Could be something less than gratifying.
You never know.
Yeah, yeah. So, Dave, how long have you been working with Aubrey?
I've been with Aubrey for about 6 years now, since she first moved to L.A. from Boston.
Was that before she got involved with the Postmodern Jukebox or after?
Yeah, that was before. She's been with them, I don't exactly know, maybe a couple years.
She's
been doing PMJ for a couple years.
Yeah, and it's a good time to mention that if you're not familiar with Postmodern Jukebox, that's that crazy amalgamation of folks that take modern pop tunes and do them in an old school, either early jazz or Dixieland sort of way. It's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. So you've been with her for 6 years, mm-hmm. now. Tell us just a little bit about your experience working with her as far as like the kind of stuff you do, because you guys do a good mix of different things.
Yeah, definitely. It covers a lot of ground stylistically. Gear-wise, you got to be able to play everything, have sounds that work for everything. You got to be able to read. It covers everything, playing brushes. It's a fun gig for me in that regard because you get to do it all. And she herself is just so awesome. I mean, she's a total dream to work with in every way just because she's so super professional. She knows her stuff. She's a serious musician in her own right, in addition to being a singer. And, you know, she just makes everything fun and easy for the band the way it should be.
One thing I think you do have going for you with her is, since she is a trombonist, that she can speak the language, mm-hmm. as far as of being a musician, maybe a little bit more cogently than some of the other, we'll call them just vocalists or primary vocalist.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know?
Yep.
But with that in mind, when you talk about working with vocalists and being able to communicate with them, that's the first thing in particular that I think has to be, you really have to have some agreement on how you're going to go about doing things, how you're going to communicate things, mm-hmm. because, you know, let's face it, there are times that as a drummer, you do have to be a little bit of a mind reader.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to dealing with vocalists that maybe can't express themselves in proper musical terms.
Sure.
Sometimes playing faster could mean actually being a little bit louder or busier.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
But you don't really have to deal with that with Aubrey.
No, certainly not with Aubrey. Not at all. I mean, I'm getting spoiled with her for sure. But yeah, in general, that's definitely an issue. And it's something that you have to approach in my opinion, it's not something that you approach with an attitude of looking down on a singer for that being the case. But if you go in with a mindset of wanting to make the event successful or making the gig successful, it is what it is. And you just go, okay, my job is to interpret what this singer wants out of me or out of the band and to be able to deliver that regardless of how maybe well or not they're communicating that.
I have a quick story to talk about snarky singers.
I can't wait.
And it actually comes from a master of the blues who is no longer with us. It's the great Albert King. He had an issue with communication. And I got to play a few gigs with him when I was over in Memphis. And it was a wonderful, fantastic B3 player. Friend of mine named Charlie Wood that was also working with him at one time, and they were in a rehearsal at one time, and Albert heard something in the band and he didn't like it. He didn't like what was going on. He goes, "Supposed to be a C7 here." Charlie goes, I played a C7 there. And he goes, no, play a C7. And Charlie, he literally like arpeggiated a C7. He goes, here's a C7. Wham, played a C7. And like, I think what Albert really wanted was more like a C major or something. Mm-hmm. It was a totally different chord that he was naming it completely incorrectly.
Right.
And Charlie had none of it.
Threw him under the bus.
Well, and then needless to say, Charlie was left in Belgium after that. They were on the road somewhere, man. And Albert unceremoniously left him at an airport over there, which is, it's kind of par for the course. I never went on the road with him. I just did a couple of things, man, with him while he was over there.
I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who is music director for a very well-known artist right now, and he was saying one of the main parts of his job is to take something that's being asked of him that he knows won't work, and he knows what will work, and he's doing it, and still make a change in what he's doing to make it seem like he's changing something, but without, you know what I'm saying? Like walking that fine line, if you know that something's not going to work, but you have to still make a change to make it seem like you're trying something, you know, but walking that fine line, but without saying like, this is the chord I'm playing and you're wrong. You know what I mean?
Ultimately, I think one of the things that has to be built up over time is the trust between a vocalist and the rest of the band, or especially like a vocalist and a music director. That kind of trust, once you get to that point to where you know that one person is not going to intentionally do something to the other, that's, you can really kind of build up your musical acumen, so to speak, with that. Yes. And you guys can do a lot of stuff, walk the razor's edge, so to speak, and doing musical things, musically challenging things.
Absolutely.
Because I've said it, man, a million times. I've gotten to the point with what I do that I will work with virtually anybody, right? But a steady, ongoing working relationship with somebody, it's got to be somebody that I get along with. I'm not one of those guys, man, that can be on stage with somebody for 2 hours a night, right? And then you have to completely and totally go your separate way and be on different buses and different planes and stuff from going place to place. I don't see how people do that.
Yep, I'm totally with you on that.
I don't see how they do it.
Yep.
You know? So, now, let's talk a little bit about the drummer's role with a singer. You've got another great story about it. I know you've got something here written about Actual Proof, which is, let's talk about that. But also, I want to get to that Miles Copeland thing that you were alluding to as well, because that in itself, that's the money.
Literally. Mm-hmm. Well, the Actual Proof thing, I mean, that kind of circles back around to the concept that as an instrumentalist, you have to have an appreciation and a respect for why you are there with a gig to begin with a lot of times, which is because of the vocalist, you know. And the Actual Proof story was when we were on tour with Aubrey last month, we did a West Coast run, and I had Aubrey's tour manager take a video halfway through the show. We do an instrumental so that Aubrey can leave stage, do a little costume change, do whatever. And for that tour, we were playing Actual Proof. And to me, that was like one of my favorite moments of the show every night. We got to really stretch out and play. And as the tour went on, it grew and just was getting really to a cool place. And so I'm like, hey, can you take a video of Actual Proof? She took it from the back of this theater we were playing. And it was a killer night. Like the tune sounded great. And as we're playing, you're just watching in front of the iPhone camera people like filing out of the theater to go to the bathroom and whatever. It's like the seventh inning stretch when the instrumental comes up, and we, you know, everyone in the rhythm section looked at that and we just laughed, like, you know, the tune was so killing, and everyone's like, oh yeah, there's no singer, I'm out. So it was just funny, but in a way it kind of makes you realize, you know, oh yeah, well, this is what people are here for, you know.
It kind of goes back to I had a friend that he used to make a joke about that same situation, and he would act like he was somebody in the audience that were like, you know, they were talking to their buddy or talking to the wife, and it was like, what kind of a song is it that ain't got no words?
Exactly.
So, yeah, you definitely experienced that.
Exactly.
Huh? Well, you could probably also tell at that time who were the musicians in the audience because everybody, you know,
for sure.
knows that that...
And that reaction is different by the room we're in and the town we're in. You know, when we were at like Ronnie Scott's or Yoshi's or like some of these real music rooms, mm-hmm. that wasn't the case. But,
right.
you know, it just depends where you are.
Now, I love this thing that you and I were talking about before the mics started rolling because I think it sounds like you and I are both big fans of the movie itself. But there's a great scene in this movie from, and I'm going to call him a very exasperated mm-hmm. Miles Copeland mm-hmm. because you could tell, man, he was on 10 when the camera was going on this. And it had to do a little bit with the pure economics, mm-hmm. we'll call it, mm-hmm. of singers versus sidemen.
Yep.
You know, and the real reason for, in so many ways, why certain sidemen even exist.
Yeah.
You want to tell that?
Yeah. Story? So the movie we're talking about is Bring on the Night, and it's the scene where Sting's band, Omar Hakim, and all those guys basically are asking Miles Copeland for more money. And he just kind of goes off on this tirade saying, you know what? If we're playing at Madison Square Garden, if you don't show up, if the keyboard player doesn't show up, you know, who's going to want their money back? Who's going to care? And he says, if Sting doesn't show up, every single person is going to want their money back. And his point in that is, you know, you got to basically, you've got to realize it's not about you. And as a sideman, I think that's a helpful mindset to maintain. And I don't even necessarily think of that as a negative. I mean, for us as sidemen, that being the case, we can use that to our advantage too. You know, I mean, we don't necessarily, depending on the gig, we have a little more flexibility to maybe send a sub or be able to juggle other gigs and things like that. So it's not, I don't interpret that as a bad thing, but it's a good thing to keep in mind for sure.
It also really illustrates the point that we've talked about time and time again on this show. And that point is never forget that even when you go on YouTube and you see all these virtuosic guys, man, you got your Virgil Donati's and your Thomas Lang's and all these guys and JoJo Mayer's, mm-hmm. that still the primary role of the drummer is accompanist, timekeeper, mm-hmm. right? Sure. That's our thing. Yep. And I state over and over again to students as well, is that if you find yourself in a position that you feel like it's maybe, we'll call it just the most basic timekeeper, or it's just the most basic role as a drummer, cherish that from the standpoint that it gives you an opportunity to set your mind in a certain way to where if you can make that a very musical and challenging situation from the standpoint of making that time feel as good as it possibly can be, keeping that tempo steady, find the joy in that. That's what you have to do.
Absolutely. And find the joy in, if you are playing something simple, find the joy in having the opportunity to add depth to your simplicity.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If you're going to play 1 and 3 on the kick and 2 and 4 on the snare, it's not going to feel like Jim Keltner doing that. And then you got to go, well, why not? Because he has a lot of depth in his playing, and it's kind of like an intangible thing, but it's something that you can always be striving toward, and regardless of the situation you're in.
That's a great point. It's also the sort of the same point that I make a lot of times, again, not to get back to the student thing, but to get back to the point of musical depth, it's all in the hands of the player. I'll talk with a student about, say, something as simple mm-hmm. as a single stroke roll. And I'll say a single stroke roll is very simple, isn't it? In other words, we can go out and we can grab the mailman mm-hmm. walking down the street, and we can bring him in and put 2 sticks in his hand and just go play right, left, right, left, right, left. It's mm-hmm. very simple, mm-hmm. right? But there's a huge difference in that mailman picking up those sticks and just going right, left, right, left, right, left, and then giving those same sticks to Steve Gadd and say, play a single stroke roll. Even at the same tempo, there's a massive difference in the way that it sounds and the way that it feels.
Yep.
And it comes from that experience and that garnered musical depth over decades of time.
Yep.
So that's an excellent point, man. And it's everything. It's all of these small subtleties. You know, you sit there and you think about, well, you know, the way that I'm phrasing the hi-hat on this, you know, it's such a small and such a tiny thing. But if you add up like six of those subtleties inside of one groove, that's when you start really getting inside of time and you start getting inside of feel to where that musical depth really comes into play.
Yeah, and I think this is a term I may have gotten from you, actually, from listening to the show, but you want to have a little bit of technical headroom in your playing.
Yeah.
Is that what you call it?
That's but my thing.
That's
man.
Your thing, man. I love that idea. I love that concept that you don't want to be maxed out playing the hardest thing you can possibly play. You know, when you're playing simply and you're capable of more than that, that comes across. That's part of where the depth comes from. I believe, you know.
Yeah, the worst thing in the world is be hanging on for your life.
Totally.
Because the only thing you can think of is hanging on for dear life at that time. You can't think in terms of any kind of musical phrasing or standpoint.
Yeah, you're
at
just
all.
In survival mode.
That's exactly right. Now, one of the things that's important, of course, in any style of music that we play and in any configuration of music we play, it's dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, when you're working with vocalists, and in your case right now, pretty much acoustic vocalists. There's you guys are playing like electric bass and there's some electric keyboards, but it's not electric from the standpoint of like this is a major rock or pop kind of a thing.
Right.
So you have to still be concerned with the drummer for the most part being the dynamic barometer,
absolutely,
so to speak.
That's right.
Now, is there one particular thing that you think of as far as like, I need to set my dynamics at this. If I can hear this or if I can be this, I know I'm going to be okay. And then after we talk about that, we'll get into a little bit more of the details of dynamics.
Yeah, well, I think the main thing is just making sure you can hear everyone else. Because if you're playing at a volume where you can't hear the vocalist, the chances are they probably can't hear themselves as well as they would like either. And you're absolutely right. You know, the drums set the stage volume for the most part for a lot of gigs. So when it's different, even playing with Aubrey, playing more or less the same show every night, that still varies quite a bit from room to room. You know, there are some rooms where we can really just go all in, and sometimes it's a very much a consideration as the stage volume. So I base it on, you know, my monitor level. And a lot of times if we have an acoustic piano, if I can hear the piano acoustically, I'll use that as a gauge, and just for sure being able to hear the vocals all the time.
That acoustic piano thing is that's my main barometer, is that. If I can be under that for the most part volume-wise, I feel like everything else is going to be okay.
Yep.
Now, a couple of questions about dynamics with some more specific styles of music that you play, because it is different for different things. Having seen you guys perform a month or so ago, you guys cover that wide gamut of different styles, man. You'll rip into a swing tune, and the next thing you're playing a pop ballad, and the next thing after that you're doing even more of like a fusion-y kind of thing. It's more aggressive. When you're going through and you're playing those different styles, you have, of course, different feels that you're dealing with. And endemically, like, for example, when you're playing one of these fusion-type things, just the overall kit volume is going to be louder when you do that.
Yep.
Is there anything that you try to keep in mind then at that time? Is it kind of the same thing? You got to make sure you hear the vocalist at that time, even though, say, your snare drum is going to be significantly louder on that kind of a tune?
Yeah, I don't differentiate it by style necessarily, but, I mean, hopefully the ensemble is rising and falling together in those moments. You know, it's not just the drums getting louder, but you're right. I mean, I'm never losing, even on louder stuff, I'm never losing sight of being able to hear everything all the time. And if that ever goes away, then I know we got a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I know also that with this one particular bass player that I work with quite a bit, we've had some conversations similar to this before. And we also talk about things from the standpoint of when we go from swing to when we go to like a straight eighth type rock backbeat bass thing, not a bossa nova, but more like a straight eighth backbeat thing. We also talk a little bit about beat placement and kind of who is the leader as far as like kind of who's really setting that type thing. Mm-hmm. And this is getting just a little bit away from the vocalist thing for a minute, but I want to ask you a question. Have you ever had that conversation or have you ever thought about it, that type thing? Because I'll tell you where I'm coming from on that, and something that it seems like I've found a little bit of common ground with some rhythm section guys on. It seems to me like most people agree that when there's a swing tune going on, we're playing some, whether it be really a shuffle or if it's a straight up swing tune and the bassist is walking mm-hmm. quarter notes and there's not a snare drum backbeat, but rather if we're say like a hi-hat backbeat mm-hmm. on 2 and 4, mm-hmm. I always allow that bassist to do the majority of the setting of the time in the feel. Like if he wants to put it on front of the beat, he's got that walking bass line that he does it, mm-hmm. right? And then I think in terms of straight eighth note stuff, backbeat oriented straight eighth note stuff, I'm the man on that. As mm-hmm. far as like I allow that backbeat and the placement of that backbeat as being the dictator of kind of where that time is going to sit. I'm going to lay that backbeat back a little bit. I'm going to put that backbeat forward a little bit. Because that's the way my mind thinks of ahead and behind the beat with straight eighth note stuff. I don't necessarily think of it in terms of like hi-hat and bass drum doing stuff. I think about it where I put the snare drum to give it that feel.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah. Two things about that. I totally agree with everything you said. And I think the reason for that is if you're talking about a straight ahead thing, I think the responsibility for the time to some extent comes from whoever is playing the most consistent repetitive thing. So yeah. In other words, like if it's a straight ahead thing and the bass player is walking quarter notes and we as the drummer are more free to mm-hmm. venture off and do things, then, you know, naturally the bass player is going to maybe be a little more responsible. Whereas if it's a pop thing, the bass part may be very sparse or syncopated or whatever, but you're probably going to have eighth notes on the hi-hat and 2 and 4 on the snare. And that's where the consistency and repetition is coming from. And so I think that's natural for people to look to that for the time. Does that make sense?
You actually said that much better than I did. That's exactly what I meant.
But that's what I take from what you're saying. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Now, while we're on that kind of tempo and setting feel type thing, let's talk about tempos and how they relate to singers.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, man, you had a couple of jewels, man, before we actually started recording regarding that.
Always record.
Yeah, always, always be record. Yeah, what is it? ABR. Always be recording. Exactly. We should have been recording at dinner last night also.
Oh man.
Somehow I gotta
I've already texted Aubrey about your story from dinner.
I feel like somehow we've got to shoehorn that story in because it pretty much means everything, doesn't it?
It needs to happen.
Yeah. From the other side of playing with singers. But let's talk about tempo and how it affects, we'll call it like the vocal diction,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, of singers. Now, the first thing I want to talk about, let's talk about ballads.
Okay.
Because you have to look at both sides of these things from the way it affects everything as far as like elongated notes to diction and that mm-hmm. type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What were you saying about ballads and slow tempos?
Well, I kind of think of all tempos the same in that regard. But what I was saying is like, you know, first and foremost, I think singers get a bad rap with drummers about being very picky about tempos. And like, you know, the old, I think Chaldon put it on my Facebook thread. What did the drummer say to the singer? Where do you want this one? Too fast or too slow? You know,
yeah,
classic, right. You know, mm-hmm. mentality. But the thing that I think people don't realize is it really affects the vocalist's ability. If a song is too slow and they have a long note that they have to hold out, I mean, that's like a physical breath thing. You know, it's hard to hold out a note for too long if a song is too slow. And on the flip side of that coin, if it's a more up-tempo tune and the song is too fast and they have a lot of lyrics they have to get out, it makes it too hard for them to be able to get out all the lyrics and have them be clear and make sense. And so I think that, I mean, I know I'm trying to like make peace in the Middle East here, but I think for us as drummers to be able to have a little more sympathy in that regard for singers, that for us to play a song 10 BPM faster or slower really changes nothing. But for a singer, that changes everything. And so you got to be sensitive to that.
And I will never give a singer guff about wanting to really hammer home that point, because I'm always, I feel like the voice of reason in groups when mm-hmm. it comes to that situation, because I know from many times of personal experience that certain singers are not even aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about on both tempo extremities. Mm-hmm. Like I've been playing in particular with like certain jazz musicians, and invariably somewhere along the way, somebody in the audience wants to sing, right? Oh, my son or my daughter or whatever is a great singer, and they want to sing this ballad, right? And they'll come in and I'll say, well, look, you know, let's do this. What, do you have a tempo in mind? And they're like, and then they count it off really, really slow. Mm-hmm. And man, it just becomes a train wreck because they don't have the breath support or the technique to hold those things out. And then likewise, also from the other standpoint, there's been times, and I will leave these names to not harm the living on this. Let's just say that I've been in the position of playing with some oldies singers. Mm-hmm. And they want tempos of songs that were massive hits at medium tempos.
Mm-hmm.
Songs that if I mention them right here on the show right now, everybody would know them. And they literally want them 25 to 30 BPM faster.
Right.
Right? And it just sounds like crap because they can't get the words out.
Right.
They're afraid of holding out those longer notes because of breath support. But they're not even thinking, or either don't care, that they can't even get the words out.
Right.
During those. So I on the flip side, will absolutely appreciate when a singer is cognizant of that. And they'll say, look, let's try to keep this thing nailed right to the record tempo. Because again, in the word of John, John's not here today, but he's come up about five times already on this show. John says, for example, with like those Michael Jackson
right.
tunes.
And, yeah, I know what you're going to say.
He's like, are you going to tell Quincy Jones, who probably spent 2 weeks finding the right tempo
right.
for these particular songs to be recorded at, that, you know, 117 is not the right tempo yep. for Don't Stop Till You Get Enough?
Right.
That it should be at 124?
Right. Well, and which brings up another point, which I think is very common in inexperienced singers, which is the idea that tempo equals energy.
Right.
So, you know, I want more energy in this, therefore it needs to be faster. That's false. You know, there are ways to bring energy. And same with dynamics. It needs more energy, so it needs to be louder. That's not, you know, that's common, but that's not the case. There are right ways to do that.
Absolutely.
That are unrelated to tempo.
Well, now, as a segue to that, if you have a vocalist that, let's say they know what they want, okay, and they're very good at communicating it mm-hmm. to you, do you ever have issues, or do you ever approach it a different way even, if they say, you know what, man, on this section, let's say the whole band drops out and mm-hmm. it's a little bit of a vocal a cappella type thing. Say mm-hmm. it could be a couple bars, could be four bars, where they're just carrying time through that.
Mm-hmm.
If they ever say, you know what, Dave, I feel like I need something to keep me in line there. You know what I mean? Maybe like a little bit of hi-hat, or maybe even, how about this? How about even when I get to the end of this four bar phrase, I need some kind of a fill to lead me back in, lead the rest of the band back in on time.
Yeah.
How you feel about that?
Oh, I feel like that's my whole life. That's the gig.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do. No doubt. I mean, and you know, it's different in different situations. If you're playing with a click that not everybody has in their ears, you absolutely got to be giving it to them if, you know, if there's a section of no drums or something like that. But I mean, that's like that's two different questions. You know, the thing of keeping time through a gap, I think that's pretty essential and pretty normal. Or you are okay with probably the tempo is going to lag a little bit. Let's say, you know, there's a bridge where the drums drop out. Either people are going to want some hat or some cymbals through there, or it's going to dip and you're going to have to bring it back up. I mean, that's just the reality of 99% of gigs, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's very normal. And the thing about, you know, leading into a next phrase with a fill, it depends, you know, there are a lot of times where, in particular with vocalists, for a variety of reasons, you're going to need to be vamping. Let's say you're going to have to vamp an intro while they're speaking, or mm-hmm. you're going to have to vamp a bridge section while they're, you know, doing whatever. So in those cases, the singer is not counting measures or even reading music necessarily. And so I feel with a lot of the singers I work with, you know, my wife, we have in common that our wives are singers. With my wife on the stuff that we do together, or with a couple other people, they really rely on that, you know, and because if they are mentally somewhere else, they're not thinking like, where am I in the phrase? They're thinking about, you know, why is that person in the front row not smiling at me? What's the, you know, like a million different things, you know, they're thinking about trying to like entertain an audience or whatever the case may be. So it's the least we can do to, try to help that along. And when it's time, you know, we will make it very obvious and fill into that and set up the next section as best we can, I think.
The reason I ask that is because I've literally had this conversation with other musicians who are offended at that. And I understand the concept of like, okay, we're all up here and we're all keeping time. And mm-hmm. we are. Mm-hmm. You know, that's definitely a valid thing. But there's this underlying sort of a feeling that with a lot of people that this is the way that it has to be, or the way that it should be. How about that? This is the way that it should be. But there's a big difference in the way things should be and the way things really are.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people get miserable or become dark whenever they get stuck in that land of like, this is the way things should be.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, that's not the way that they are. So it's really refreshing, man, to hear you say that.
Well, I think if you're going to get hung up on the difference between the way things ought to be and the way they are, mm-hmm. you're going to be a miserable human being. I mean,
doesn't matter what you're doing. Even if you're an accountant or a car salesman, you're going to be miserable.
Across your life or on a gig, you know. I mean, I just think you're getting off on the wrong foot to have that mindset, because you got to just look at the situation and say, here we are. What can everyone do, myself included, to make the best outcome? And so, sure, there are a lot of things. I mean, anything, your monitor mix, your whatever, you know, that ought to be a certain way that's not. But it's part of being a professional, I think, is to play the hand you're dealt and make it work no matter what.
You're exactly right, man, that that whole thing of like the way things are versus the way things should be. Another way that I've approached people who get hung up on that is I always say to them like this, and this is going to lead into our next thing. I want to talk about count-offs in a second, mm-hmm. okay? For example, some people will get bummed out when it comes to, say, something like count-offs or something that they might be used to doing, but somebody else in the band has decided they're going to do it mm-hmm. at this time. And it's like, well, man, I've been doing it, and, you know, why don't I go ahead and do that? And they get all bummed out. This is the way that it should be because I've been doing that. Well, the other thing that you should always keep in mind is maybe in a situation like that, certain things don't rank quite as high on the importance level with other people as it does with you, and vice versa. There's going to be other things for them that's going to rank significantly higher on mm-hmm. the importance level mm-hmm. than they do with you. You know, that sort of thing. And so if you kind of keep that hierarchy in mind, as far as like that, you know, there's got to be some compromise and some give and take. Somewhere down the road, it's going to reciprocate.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. You got to pick your battles, because mm-hmm. there will be, 99% of stuff, I'm going to let it slide, you know, but there may be there may come an issue that is a non-negotiable thing for me, and that's when I'm going to speak up. If it has to be a certain way, it has to be a certain way. But you can't be someone who operates that way at every turn about every little thing, you know?
Yeah.
You got to pick your moments.
Now, with the count-ins,
mm-hmm.
okay, do you do the count-ins, all of the count-ins with Aubrey's group?
Not really, because, well, we've actually been discussing this lately. There are three, I would say, different things that will happen. Number one, the drums will start the song, like either with a count-in or with a drum groove. There are one or two songs. There are two songs that Aubrey counts off because it's kind of like part of the show is for her to like, she has a little thing that she'll say and then she'll count off the song.
Right.
As kind of part of the show. Or the third thing would be some of the more ballady stuff that starts out rubato, starts with piano, and then maybe the drums come in on the chorus or second verse or something like that where nobody counts it in. It just flows in. But actually, Nick Petrillo and I, her keyboardist, who's a really good friend of mine, we were having this conversation just on the last, when we were in Europe a few weeks ago and we were trying to like just really tweak the flow of Aubrey's show, and we're just always trying to make it better. And one of the things that Nick had suggested to me was like, hey man, what if on the songs that you would count off, what if you don't count it off and you just start playing the groove and then we come in? Because it, you know, to him that was going to make it more seamless mm-hmm. and just more like, unless it's very deliberate, we don't really want to have any dead space in the show.
Right.
So like we'll end a song and we tried it. And I just told Aubrey before we went on stage, I'm like, hey, this is something we were talking about. We're going to try it. And she's like, great. Love it. Let's do it. And it seemed to work well. We've been doing it, you know, the last few shows. That's how it's been. And I think it's cool. Just start with the groove instead of a count off. I mean, you can't get away with that all the time. If it's something very like rigid where everyone needs to be in together on an intro, you can't do that. But for Aubrey's thing, at least it seems to work just to kind of like keep the flow moving of the show.
I like it, man. I do that also with several different groups that I work with. I call it, it's sort of the jukebox theory of doing things.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as one, after you hit the last chord on the last song, it's almost like the second one is just flowing right into it. It's almost like a DJ mix master.
Exactly.
Just, you know what I mean? Going from one tune to the next.
And I got hip to that concept first, I would say, from my wife on the church thing that we do. Because she's not an instrumentalist, it's not like she's going to stand up there with her acoustic guitar and start the next song. She didn't want any dead space. And she's like, you got to go right into the next thing. Sometimes without a count off at all. Sometimes, in fact, on our church thing that we do, the song doesn't stop. I will start playing the next tempo straight away, like hit the last note and go into the next thing. So doing it like that, I got used to it. And I just think that it makes for a better flow. And the corporate band I used to do too, I did a corporate band for like 8 or 9 years, and that band leader dude was adamant. Like when we're into the second and third set of the dance stuff, there cannot be dead space because people will leave the dance floor like immediately. So that was another thing. I would count off those songs, but you know, early on in my time in that gig, I was a little more like tentative and like look around and make sure everyone's ready and I'll start the song, you know. And it didn't take me long to figure out, like, it ain't that kind of party. Like, I'm counting this off. If you're not ready, there are going to be two bars of drums and people will still be dancing and it won't matter. And you can get on the bus when you're ready, you know. But it's better that than dead space.
I agree, man. I completely agree. I used to think that it would somehow be perceived as being unprofessional, that everybody's kind of falling in. But it doesn't take long. It probably doesn't even take a set.
Mm-hmm.
That even if a band is not used to that,
mm-hmm.
there's a weird thing that happens that if the drummer just kind of takes the bull by the horns and you just go, okay, man, I'm blasted. As soon as that last chord is hit, sometimes even when it's still fading out, to start the next set of tempo or set the next groove.
Yep.
A lot of times, man, after two bars, the whole band just comes in instantly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They kind of get into this flow. And they realize, okay, what's going on? And then it just feels right, man, after a couple bars or four bars that the band starts.
And if they're expecting a two-bar count-off, what's the difference of them hearing two bars of a new tempo from the groove coming in?
That's a good point,
man. You know what I mean? It's the same.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
And from the audience standpoint, it's way better.
There are also a couple of groups that I play with, and also on one of the church gigs that I play, that we use a lot of sequences. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of gotten into a flow now also that with certain sequences, we can chain them together, so to speak.
Right.
And we can actually get the count ins to do that same thing, like where a last chord is fading out. Mm-hmm. You can actually get a count in to happen underneath that.
Yeah.
With the sequence.
Right.
You know, so that's a great thing, man.
And that's great because then the sequence is doing the hard part for you.
Yeah.
you don't have to think about two tempos at the same time.
out of curiosity, I know Aubrey's such a good musician. Did you ever have to coach her on proper count-ins?
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, she's so good. No. Because, I mean, and what I mean by that, I mean, you know, it's very important that when you're doing a variety of styles, whether it be straight, eighth, or swing, that you have the proper count-in because mm-hmm. you don't count a swing tune off the same way and right. the same feel, of course, that you count a right. straight eighth note tune out, which leads me to another story, Dave. a good buddy of mine, who I think listens to the show, his name is Tim Paul. Mm-hmm. He has one of the best singer count-in stories that I've ever heard, man. It's one of the best ones ever. And it happened, he had a steady gig at a little club where they were doing primarily standards, you know, jazz standards, like cocktail style things. And he had a really good little trio that was backing up a female vocalist. And as part of the show, this vocalist would occasionally take a tune and count it in. And she was doing this one tune that was in three. It was mm-hmm. a waltz. But she would count it off in four, right?
I love it.
Because it was just one of those things. She just got used to doing that.
That's how all count offs are, right?
And right?
Just count off
in four. They're all in
four,
right?
That's how it works.
So what ended up happening was, invariably somewhere down the line, someone had to sub,
uh-huh.
right?
Oh, gosh.
And so I think it was a bassist was subbing in on the gig. And it got to that part of the night where they were going to do this one tune that was a waltz. And she was going to count it off in four. And so Tim says, okay, we're going to do this. And here we go. And the girl gets up there and she's getting ready to count it off in four. And as soon as she starts to count, Tim remembers that, oh my gosh, she's going to count this thing off.
The alarm bells are going off.
Yeah, she's going to count this thing off. But it's got to, you know, the tune's in three.
Right.
And she starts to count off. She goes, one, two. And Tim goes, don't listen to her. And he says it loudly to
watch
where,
my right hand.
Yeah, where everybody can hear it. And she literally stops the count off right then and turns around and says to him, he's like, Tim, what do you mean? Don't listen to me. You know, that so it turns into like this big thing right in front of the audience, you know.
On the job training.
On the job training, man. The harshest possible consequences. So, I don't know. That's a little charming story
that's
to talk
great,
about.
Man. I love that.
Dealing with singers. Now,
yeah, this isn't a singer thing, but there's a trumpet player in town that I used to play with from time to time named Richie Friedman. And that it was a jazz thing more or less. And he had a book, and a lot of the charts, for being otherwise good charts, they don't always necessarily tell you what the feel is going to be. And so when he counted off tunes, man, I would pull up, he would call whatever the number is. I'm looking at the chart and I'm expecting it by default to be a swing sort of thing. And he counts off this thing, man, at the top of his lungs. One, two, one and two and three and four. And that's his count off. And I'm like, thank the Lord.
Yeah.
And I went up to him after the first time I played with him. I walked up to him. I said, man, I really appreciate the way you count off tunes. And similarly with a swing thing. I mean, there was no doubt from his count off that you are going to be playing a swing feel. And I told him, man, I wish everybody counted off tunes like that because it just makes it so clear and so easy.
Not only does it make it clear, but when there's that kind of confidence in there, it also, if you're really listening, man, it tells you exactly even where to place the tempo from the standpoint of like, you can kind of tell, man, if it's going to be something, it's going to be up on the front of the beat,
mm-hmm.
that it's going to be maybe laid back a little bit.
Sure.
That's yeah. that's
I
awesome.
I mean, a good count off will convey the attitude as well.
Yeah.
For sure.
Uh-huh. There is an art to that, for yep. to counting off tunes.
Yep.
I used to have a bad problem. This was years ago. And I finally came,
I got aware of it by listening to some recordings, and it was to live stuff. I had an inherent issue with putting things too far on the front of a beat, or in other words, or pushing a tempo too much with a count in, right? Perhaps just rushing a count in.
Oh, and laying then it back when you actually start playing.
Yeah, and then it laying mm-hmm. back immediately when it started right. playing. And man, that was a pretty rude awakening mm-hmm. to be able to do that. So I totally believe in that whole art of the count in.
But you realize that on your own from listening to recordings of yourself?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's the way to do it, man.
Well, as a teacher of mine used to say, if you realize that you have an issue, you're better off than 2/3 of the rest of the population, because most people don't realize they have the issue.
There you go.
So Dave, let's say you're in the middle of a tune and you hear a vocalist either pushing or dragging.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to realize that, you know, since the rhythm section, we're definitely in charge of being the accompanist and trying to keep some sensibilities as mm-hmm. far as like keeping a tasteful rein on tempo.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to realize that you don't want to be too heavy-handed with trying to like rein someone in, rope them in at the tempo. I think there's a good balance mm-hmm. of being able to be flexible enough, you know, amenable to different things.
Yep.
What are your thoughts if you hear somebody pushing, a vocalist pushing, or a vocalist dragging on their phrasing?
Well, to me, that completely depends on who it is, you know, because there
personality-wise, you're talking about, or?
Well, it what I mean is, like, it depends on my knowledge of their musicality. So, in other words, if I hear Aubrey doing that, I'm going to take notice because she's doing it on purpose. Whereas if it's most other people, and if it's someone I don't know, I'm not going to go in with an attitude of like, you can dictate the time to me by your phrasing as a vocalist. Like, because 9 times out of 10, they probably just have bad time and they need to get with you. So what, like, there are exceptions to that. Like, my wife will do that too. And you know, when they do it more so, is if it's like one of those tunes I was talking about earlier with like a rubato piano intro
mm-hmm.
where there's a lot of leeway for what the tempo could be, you know, and Nick and Aubrey are so in sync in this regard, but Nick is very good at following her, but she will definitely put it where she wants it, man. And it's on purpose and it's right. And so you have to listen to what she's doing and be sensitive to that. And that's, you can't like just steamroll over that and say, I'm going to do my thing. You know, you got to be aware. But like I said, that comes back to what you were saying earlier about having a trust with somebody. I mean, Aubrey and I have a musical trust that if there's an issue like that, it's going to be addressed non-verbally and we're going to read each other like that. But if it's somebody I'm not as familiar with or not comfortable working with, I'm not going to defer to them moving the time around vocally. I'm not, you know.
But let me give you a very specific example, okay? Let's say that you're doing a tune with them to where there's, again, let's say a couple bar or one bar vocal break.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, especially if it's a rock or pop tune or something that's up-tempo, there's a tendency to want to rush through that. How quick are you to correct the time when it comes back in? Do you know what I mean?
So you're saying if it's a one bar break where the drums are out and it's like a vocal break, I will give that maybe nanoseconds to go south before I'm jumping in. Because if I hear, like, if it's a one bar break and within the first couple beats, I mean, it's hard to even like put into words because it happens. Your brain like does it faster than you can even like think about it.
It's astounding, isn't it?
It's crazy, yeah. Mm-hmm. But if it's a one bar break and I hear it going south in the beginning, you better believe people are getting a strong 3 and 4 on the hi-hat through the rest of that break. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or I don't even let it go past that, because if the time is going south in a break, people aren't going to necessarily come in together. Some people are going to stay true to the tempo. Some people are going to follow what's going on. So you're already, setting yourself up for disaster if you let it go through the whole break, if you hear that happening. You know what I mean?
I have developed this weird ability to allow a singer to kind of do that either rushing or dragging thing, come back in with their phrasing, and then over a period of like a bar or two, slowly pull it back or mm-hmm. push it forward back to where, sure. it, where it should be, that sort of thing. That's one of those weird things that I kind of came to this conclusion that might be a decent compromise mm-hmm. to be able to do that.
Well, that comes back to a trust thing too, of yeah. trusting the person you're working with, because if it's a situation where you don't know the other players very well, I wouldn't feel comfortable to chance that everyone's going to come in together. You know what I mean?
I'm going to do the Drummers Weekly Groovecast public service announcement here. Okay, check this out. Okay, for all you working drummers out there, if you're in a situation where you have to play that journey tune any way you want it, okay, that's the one that starts out with, there's some band kicks right uh-huh. at the beginning, but then it's all vocal a cappella stuff, right, uh-huh. for the first few bars of that. The universal axiom of vocal phrasing is that you rush that, no matter how you count it off. Even if you got a click going, they want to rush those first few bars of what essentially ends up being like the chorus hook, right? Right. Any way you want it, that's the way you get it, right. You know, that sort of thing. I've come up with a way using that because, like I said, there are band kicks all the way through. Playing those band kicks in time with their rushing as mm-hmm. they're going through that, and then slowly kind of peeling back the tempo to a decent tempo, man, once the thing gets going. So everybody work on those chops of any way you want it.
Well, that's an art, being able to compromise, you know, because at the end of the day, you want the music to sound as good as it can, and that's not always necessarily digging your heels in and being the one who's right. Sometimes it's, you know, going with it.
There's a great musician here in town, a legendary guitarist named Bill Hatcher, that we were on a gig one time, and he was like, man, I know for a fact that this guy that we're playing with tonight is playing some wrong or at least questionable changes on some of these songs. Mm-hmm. But he goes, man, it's my job to make this thing agree and make musical sense out of it, because even though that might have been the wrong chord, if they at least agreed on the chord,
right.
it's not going to be a train
wreck.
If
two people are playing the wrong thing together, it's going to sound better than
right.
one person trying to fix it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then if you can subtly fix something such as tempo over a gradual piece of time, like mm-hmm. a couple of measures, it's going to take a pretty astute ear to
right.
the listening audience to pick up on that
sure.
sort of thing. And again, that's where you kind of get into the musical depth aspect of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to a greater point, which is, you know, whether you're working with a vocalist or not, it's not your job to be right.
There you go.
You know what I mean? And I think a lot mm-hmm. of people, for whatever reason, man, a lot of people have that mentality, like, I'm right, and people got to get with this because I'm right, you know? And it's like, that's not the best way to do it, you know?
That's part of the mental thing that I think that's related to this is the way things should be.
Yeah, yeah.
Not necessarily the way that things are.
Yep.
I used to also be guilty from the standpoint of relating back to times that I was taught certain things by these musical mentors that I've had that I just took as like, man, this is the law.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Bible, you know, and they are right. But sometimes in a professional setting and in a performance setting, sometimes you have to bend those laws a little bit, like you were saying, because even though, man, you know, this is the way that it should be, you know, sometimes you have to break free of that dogma and take that road that's going to make things sound right and be easier to work with. And then maybe over time, you know, you can compromise and
yeah.
get
and
a little
I,
bit
I think
more
that's
towards
just like a freelance sideman mentality is one thing will be right tonight, and on your other gig tomorrow with other people, that won't be right. And you got to be able to flex with that and be able to quickly assess your situation and do what's right for that situation, knowing that it may be exactly right tonight and it may be exactly wrong tomorrow night, you know?
These gigs that we do, they're pretty much always free-flowing and morphing from night to night. So, yeah, what went true the previous night may be null and void the next night.
Yep. Even with the same people from night to night, that, to some extent.
That's true. Our guest, Chris Fryer, made a point on his show. You know, he plays with Zach Brown's band. We were talking about tempo, and we were talking about making things feel good and stuff. And he was saying that not only do things change from night to night, but sometimes on the same night, things change from verse to chorus.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean, that pretty much says it all right there. And those guys play a lot, and they're really on the same page. So they really know and really respect what each of them are doing.
But if they're all doing that together, it's all good.
Exactly.
That sounds great.
Yeah, that's a good little band too, man. Those guys, man, harmonies and vocal-wise and just musicality, man, they're a very strong group.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Dave, we've been going, believe it or not, for a little over an hour here.
Oh, man, we haven't gotten to half of them yet.
And I know there are some things in particular that you want to talk about, and there's also some things that you want to talk about where people can come and see you as well.
Well, one other point I was going to make is knowing the kind of singer you're working for and what they want. Because, you know, and that this all comes back to, like, having a flexible approach yourself as a musician. And the example I always tell people with Aubrey is, for example, I'm her music director, and so we've done a handful of gigs where she and I will just travel and hire a band locally. And so we have this way of, like, communicating quickly to the other musicians what she wants and what we need to have delivered and stuff. And one of the first things she always tells other musicians is, I would rather you ask for forgiveness than permission. And what she's doing in one statement is giving people a green light to be aggressive, be free to be yourself, be interactive, don't be timid. You know, all of that is conveyed. And so for a new person coming in to work with someone like Aubrey, that's important information to have, because that's not always the case. I think that's the exception, not the rule, to have for an artist to have that mindset working with new musicians, you know. And that purely comes from her own, you know, total confidence and comfort in what she does. So my point is, you are going to be most successful if you have as clear an understanding as possible of what that particular artist or vocalist is looking for. So for Aubrey to say that's somebody, you may turn around the next night and work with somebody who that's the absolute wrong approach and, you know, will get you fired to have that mentality. You know what I mean? Like, some people need you to keep it very, like, in the box and just, like, play safe and whatever so that they're comfortable. So you just, as much as possible, to have an idea of who you're working for and what they're looking for, that you have the ability to deliver and tailor your approach to what they want.
Now, with that in mind, okay, how do you go about sussing that out? Do you ask a lot of questions, or do you allow your, like, mental and musical background and depth suss that out over a certain period of time?
It's more that, and I think it's more, I mean, if it's a situation where you don't have the benefit of having a lot of conversations along those lines, if you don't really know, I mean, definitely you go in erring on the side of being a little safe, and you can kind of, like, let's say if you're the one new person and it's established thing with everyone else, start out playing it a little more conservatively and just be super observant of what's going on around you. Is the keyboard player very interactive with the vocalist? Is it this or that? You know, or is everyone, like, really, like, glued to a page and just reading it down? You know, just take your cues from what's going on around you if you don't have the ability to actually talk to the person about it. But absolutely, at that point, you're totally relying on your instincts and your experience to inform that.
I always try to do exactly what you're saying. In other words, play from the side of just being very simple and be the primary timekeeper. Go in as a blank slate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do the best you can to not have preconceived notions of kind of, like, you know, this person's reputation precedes themselves,
right.
You know, from that. Just be open, play simply, but play confidently, because people can suss that out too, man. Mm-hmm. You know, if you come in there being real timid, you know, that's really not a good thing. You got to come in there with an air of confidence, play simply, confidently, and then you know, take some direction if like, oh yeah, we want you to fill this up here and we want you to do this and,
right,
you know, that sort of thing. Yep. That's good stuff, man.
Yep. There was a singer I worked with not long ago who, again, the names are changed to protect the innocent.
Yeah.
This, you know, had a reputation that was brought to my attention that it was going to be difficult. And I went into this, just marched up, introduced myself. And I had already befriended this person on Facebook, and so I immediately brought up, "Wow, this is some awesome gig I just saw you did on Facebook. Like, how was that?" You know, like immediately just like disarm and like break down the barriers, and immediately talk about something cool that they did.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, coming from a place of sincerity. Like, I think that's great. Like, I want to get to know this person. But my point is, like, you go into the situation and try to be as non-threatening and establish early on a really cool vibe.
And sincere.
And sincere, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's very wise.
And it worked out, and we had a great time. Worked out great.
Well, Dave, I know, man, that you do have a place to be here fairly soon. You got some things you got going on tonight. Is Aubrey going to be doing any cartwheels tonight with one hand?
I mean, yeah.
for those who are unaware, if you haven't seen it, that there's a little part in the show where she does one-handed cartwheels
while singing.
If she does that with the symphony, man, there absolutely has to be some video of that. I want to see that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Dave, tell these folks what you're going to be up to over the next little bit of time, and where people can find you and see you and stay in touch with you.
Yeah, so after this run with Aubrey, we're in Augusta tomorrow night and then Spokane on Saturday night, and those are both shows with symphonies. After we get home from that run, we have the whole summer off because Aubrey is touring with Dave Koz this summer doing the Summer Horns Tour. And so, it's nice, actually, because we've been going pretty hard since I saw you guys in February. We've been basically in and out pretty regularly since then. So it's going to give us a chance to like tend to all our LA gigs and whatnot. But with Aubrey, once we pick back up in the fall, our very next thing is we're doing a show with the Boston Pops on August 12th, which I'm very excited about. And that'll be the third of these three symphony shows we're doing. And then Aubrey has also just signed a record deal. She has her one record that came out in September, which is doing really well. But she just signed on with Resonance Records.
Mm-hmm.
And so the plan is that we're going to do a record probably at this point, we're looking at October, and it would come out sometime early 2019, February-ish. And we have a fall tour planned. We're going to be doing two nights at Birdland in New York in October. And then we're doing a lot of Midwest stuff all throughout the beginning. First 2-3 weeks of November, we'll be out with that. So that's Aubrey world. And then other than that, when I get home this summer, the gigs are a little slower this summer, which is kind of nice because, number one, my wife and kids get to remember what I look like. That'll be nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a lot of stuff that I'm trying to get going for myself. I've been doing some transcriptions and blogs and video content for a website called openstudionetwork.com. And that is a buddy of mine from St. Louis, a piano player that we played together in high school. And now he does this website that is online jazz lessons. So I'm doing work with them. Mayer Brothers, which is the drum company, the drums that I play, I'm going to be doing in a couple of weeks when I get back, like a extensive product demo video for them. And he's giving me like 12 or 15 snares to just like tune up and basically like A/B and talk about what the different snares are and just do a whole bunch of video stuff with that. And I work with an artist named Cortez Alexander. We have a residency at Vitello's in LA this summer, so we'll be doing some of that. And that's about it. On my website, davejohnstone.com, I have, you know, I were talking last night about all the transcriptions we've done.
Yeah.
So I've been really hitting it hard with doing a lot of work on Sibelius lately and getting my transcription library really up to speed. And my plan is that I'm going to launch a little store on my website, like maybe for just a few bucks, like buy different transcriptions. I have stuff that's like jazz drum solos, mm-hmm. or I have on the other side of things, like full songs, like in the rock side that I've transcribed, like note for note, the entire song top to bottom. So I'll probably do like corresponding YouTube videos performing it and maybe doing a little lesson and then like direct traffic over to the store to try to sell some transcriptions.
Man, that's tremendous. And if you guys didn't get that, I will make sure to put that information in the show notes also. So please make sure you consult the show notes so you can get that information to get over to Dave's website. And by the way, I want to go ahead and piggyback onto what you were saying about your buddy from St. Louis. And what was the name of his website again that you were...
Open Studio Network.
Yeah, I've seen the first thing you did for Open Studio, and it was a bit of a lesson on how to interpret the syncopation book in a few different ways.
Yep.
And it was excellent, man. It's cool. Exactly. For somebody who wants to get working out of that book, mm-hmm. and not take it just for the face value, but actually work on it the way that like Alan Dawson yep. conceptualized, that's an excellent place to start, man. So good work there.
Cool. Thank you. They have a really awesome course called Fundamentals of Jazz Drumming, and it's all done by Greg Hutchinson. And so when I first connected with them, I like any of the Hutchinson stuff that you see transcribed on the website, I transcribed that. And then he has a cool program where it like follows right along as he's playing it, like the little thing goes and you follow with the transcription. And then after that, they reached out to me to do some blogs and video. And so I'm looking forward to being able to devote more time to that this summer.
Need to tell Hutch needs to do his own transcriptions. Come on, Hutch.
He's a busy guy.
Better than that. Also, you know, I want to throw something out there as well. For those of you folks who follow us on social media, Dave is the shining beacon of the example of what to do with Accountability Thursday. He never misses. Every week he practices. He videos himself, even when he's on the road, and then posts on social media. So if you're still not quite sure who you've been listening to today, go to our social media and watch this guy ripping up these traditional rudimental solos. We greatly appreciate it.
Trying to get more people on, man. Trying to get all my LA friends to get on board.
You know,
it's fun.
It is fun, and people are doing it, but they're so hesitant to post.
Yeah.
It really is, because they're afraid that people are going to rip them apart, you know, or it's like, man, I'm still working on the one from January the 18th, you know, or whatever. They're still working on old ones to get up there and do it. But
even that, I mean, even if people aren't posting their videos, people are getting value out of that if they're playing along at home. That's great.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of nice responses from just the standpoint of like, nobody's really doing this, mm-hmm. so this is kind of cool to make this happen.
Yeah.
And you know, you also get that, you go down that rabbit hole of when you do some of those old NARD things, you have to read into the old interpretations that are not written out in those books.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of value for some folks that want to get into that to figure that out.
That's why I love the way you do it, how there's an accompanying podcast that explains it. I think I don't know if you remember one of the early ones, you posted the video, or like you posted the YouTube video of what the solo was, and I just immediately went out and recorded it and posted it. And then I went back and listened to you describing it, and you're like, oh, on the 15 stroke roll, it's supposed to be interpreted this way. And I was like, oh man, I should have listened to it first because I did it wrong.
That's a wacky one, man. That weird old school interpretation of that 15 has thrown a lot of people
the
in the ditch.
The 3 and the 4.
Yeah.
Well, because it doesn't metrically work out over time.
No, it doesn't. You got to try to cram that 7 motions, man, into what normally you would make 6 as a 13.
So. And I love the way you describe it, you know, doing it as the triplet and then the duple, but then just sort of like making it elastic and stretching it out the right way over the right amount of time. It's tricky.
Yeah, you got to kind of draw a straight line through it and just make sure that you land as squarely on count one as you possibly can. Even though there's even a little bit of leeway on those. It's like those ternary sevens. When you play those ternary sevens, you can kind of splatter those out a little bit.
Which is another thing that was another thing that was new to me when you described that, because I always think of it more metronomically, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, dude, those 15s, I just like close my eyes and use the force and aim for the downbeat.
And that's one of the best ways you can describe it, because that's how it was described to me. I would have never have known that if I hadn't had old man Ludwig, Bill Ludwig, at one of his demonstrations back in the early 90s. he explained a couple of those things to me because I had some questions for him about that kind of stuff that nobody gave me like a really good answer for. And, you know, he was, of course, a member of NARD. He's written some of those solos and stuff, so of course he knows.
Yeah.
So he gave me a few of those magic bullets, man, on tips on that. So I would have never known it if it hadn't been from him.
You're trying to fit 15 over a space of what should be logically 13.
13.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, if I wouldn't have known that except for a chance meeting with Mr. Ludwig, there's probably a lot of people that really don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and granted, the NARD book can be interpreted a whole bunch of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And in so many ways, it's all right, because that's kind of the beauty of those NARD books, the solos, is that they're open for certain limits of interpretation.
Right.
But if you do know the traditional interpretations, why not use those?
Yeah. It's fun. You're expanding yourself and growing. It's awesome.
We've already done a mini episode of Accountability
Let's
Thursday
just chop the
here.
End of this one.
But just put it on the next one, right?
Kill two birds with one stone.
Dave, you got anything else you want to talk about, man? Or we need to wrap this thing up and put you on the road?
Well, let's see. I have page two here. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm good, man. This has been fun.
It's been great, man. I appreciate you coming out a day early and doing this.
Dude, thank you for having me. And, you know, I was looking forward to seeing John, too. But, I mean, it's cool. You know, sometimes people fly across the country to see you and you just end up having something better to do. It's cool. I understand. It happens to all of us, you know.
You know, oh, wait, here comes John. He's coming in a little bit late right now. It's all good, buddy. It's all good. All right, folks, we're going to start locking this thing down for the day and getting Dave on the road. He's got to head over to Augusta. As always, we appreciate you listening. Head on over to our website. We're at www.drummersweeklygroovecast.com. There you can find everything Drummers Weekly Groovecast. You can listen to every episode. You can listen to the aforementioned Accountability Thursday episodes along with the companion videos on our video page. You can manage your subscription there. You can also interact with us at social media, and you can also email us. Where somebody, by the way, Dave's been blowing up our email account since we were just talking on this show. Several emails have come in. I don't know, it's some kind of a harried response, some
Are
criticism
we live right now?
Well, it's something someone's not agreeing with. I'll guarantee you that somebody's got an opinion that they want to voice over something. So you can always email us. There are contact form there as well. As always, new shows come out every Monday, feature episodes. We have the first and third Thursdays for Accountability Thursday. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, anywhere you find your podcasts, you can find them. So subscribe today.
Harvey can sense that we're wrapping up.
He can.
He wants to come hang out.
He can. He wants to come out of his crate. Dave, it's been a pleasure, buddy.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Say goodbye to the good folks of Groovecastistan.
See you later, Groovecast Nation.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
My head, alarm bells start to ring, 'cause the minutes go like hours when you sing. You choose a song that you have yet to learn, and so you come in wrong, and my stomach starts to turn. And though the trio tries to make it swing, the minutes go like hours when you sing. You proceed to ruin a song I used to like. The people always clap, I can't see why. 'Cause you don't know what you're doing, so every time you take the mic, lyric might be cheerful, but it always makes me cry. If you drove like you sing, what a disaster it would be. Random speeding up and slowing down and veering out of key. You wave the mic around and make that feedback ring. All the minutes go like hours when you sing. who likes to try to sing a song. You don't see why that should bother me. Well, I like operations, so I guess there's nothing wrong if I show up at your office just to try some surgery. I practiced 30 years to be a member of this band. You sang once at your sister's wedding. You think you're welcome on the stand. Your wife may say you sound just like the king, but the minutes go like hours. You must have special powers to make those minutes go like hours when you sing.